Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is a special Best of Space Talk edition. Today, we're going to replay most of our program from July 1st of this year, which marked the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy Space Center. Hope you'll enjoy it, and we'll be back with a live show next week.
Happy, happy birthday to every girl and boy. Hope this very special day brings you lots of joy. Hope this birthday present you get from mom and dad will make this very special day the best you've ever had.
Well, a happy special birthday greetings to the John F. Kennedy Space Center, which on this very day 50 years ago was activated as NASA's Launch Operations Center, a new facility located on Merritt Island that would be built to support launching the massive Saturn V moon rocket, our nation having outgrown the space available across the Banana River at what we now call Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. Well, for the past 25 years, it has been my pleasure to be able to live and work in the shadow of the Kennedy Space Center, and I certainly could fill the rest of this hour with all sorts of stories about America's rocket ranch, but instead I'd rather hear some stories and maybe some tall tales from the three gentlemen who are sitting with me right now here in the studio. So we're going to get right into our time together. Forgo any pontificating by me during this first segment. Let me introduce my guest by saying, well, first that I grew up loving the hardware and missions that made history, but when I started working at Florida Today, well, oh my gosh, 24 years ago tomorrow, in fact, I soon learned that it was the people that made the history and the people that were most important part of the space program, and I think three of the finest are with me today. Let me tell you who they are. George Inglis, who has from time to time been called the chief bureaucrat at KSC, and usually in a nice way. Well, he taught me the meaning of the word gentleman and a whole lot more about working with people and the importance of always doing the right thing. Well, he's here. Bob Seek, the legendary shuttle launch director who taught me about launch operations and, well, while always reminding me of the importance of family. Well, he's here. And Roy Tharp is here, too, a veteran NASA and government contractor who, well, when it comes right down to it, is the guy I want to be just like if I ever grow up. So we got a lot to cover, and we're going to try to do this more or less chronologically. First of all, welcome to all you guys. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Jim.
All right, there you go. Roy Tharp, let's start with you.
Yes, sir.
You know, now, Bob and George were started working here before you did, but you have the distinction of having grown up here, so you kind of know what it was like out there before it is what it is like out there today.
Well, it was growing up on Merritt Island. Between 520 and Georgiana, there were 10 houses.
Yeah.
And mosquitoes were huge, and they were thick. If we had to go out and do chores after sundown, you held your breath no matter how long, because that first inhale, you had a mouthful of something. So, and also going to Cocoa High Schools,
yeah,
watching on the football fields, those rockets going up and doing cartwheels and blowing up. Very significant in the early days, Jim.
Very inspiring to you, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I knew that my mom, Mert Tharp,
yeah,
had Mert's Restaurant downtown Coco, Mert Tharp Square. She gave me the right work ethic and convinced me that I had to finish college. And so I did. And looking at what NASA was doing, I came to work for NASA in 1963.
Well, now talk a little bit about what was here on Merritt Island before there was a space center. You know, we know famously there was a beach house out there that was a cottage that was built out there. Were there other homes? Wasn't even there a development that was getting ready to start?
Yes. When I was going to college in the summer, I worked on a surveying crew, and we had the pleasure of surveying Kennedy Space Center. We laid out the NASA causeway. We also surveyed the housing developments and the Cape on Cape Canaveral.
Okay.
And we took and marked the houses, the ones that were being sold and the ones that were being moved. Uh-huh. And the ones that were sold and were abandoned in place, they were demolished. And yes, those roads are still there today on Cape Canaveral. I was driving by Complex 40 and just reminisced a little bit on my way past Tell 2.
Now, when KSC was first being built, now we have that causeway that goes from US 1 across to Kennedy Space Center. It goes by the visitor complex. That wasn't there then, was it? That was a man-made built-in thing?
That was man-made. We had a boat, a flat-bottom boat, and we laid the center line out starting on the Cape side coming towards KSC, going over the Banana River, and then we hit the mainland where Kennedy Space Center is, going by the headquarters building, and then the Indian River going to the mainland.
And when KSC was announced, and before it was the Merritt Island Launch Annex, the Mila area, you had the Launch Operations Center, of course, or Launch Operations Directorate reporting to Marshall, then it became the Launch Operations Center in July. At some point during all that point, when you talk about surveying, people were living out there but had to get out fast, didn't they?
Well, we only had one road when we went in, and it was through on the Cape side around the port. And you went in that way. We had traffic reports. Mobile Mike was out, and he gave everybody the traffic reports as to how it was going to be. And the only way you knew there was a launch was when you got inside the Cape, they had ops numbers on a big board. And people could not talk about launches in the early days. I dated my wife at that time, high school sweetheart, Barbara Reinholdt, and her dad worked for Douglas Aircraft. And we were chatting one day, and he goes, "We don't talk about that stuff." So Barbara and I knew from that point on not to talk about it.
George Inglis, you were here forever as well. 64, was it? 63, 64?
I came to KSC in 64.
In 64. Right. Talk about your first visit here. What was your impressions, and how did you get here?
Well, I was working for the Air Force up until I came to NASA in 64, and I had an office down at Patrick. I was the personnel officer for Air Force activities on the East Coast, and one of the offices I had was at Patrick. And some people that had worked for me came to work for NASA and invited me to come down. So I thought that was a great opportunity for me. And then that's when I came in 1964.
And when you first drove on the property, what did you think? What did you see?
Well, I remember I used to go up State Road 3 when I would leave Patrick and head back to Robins Air Force Base. And I used to hear about the bootleggers that were on State Road 3 up north of KSC. But I saw the beginnings of the VAB, that was really an inspiration.
And Bob Seek, we've got about a minute or so before we take a break. Talk about you also came about that same time.
Right. And in fact, I started in 63 with General Electric commuting from down here in Melbourne across the wooden Causeway Bridge, two-lane A1A, and when they finished the causeway up in Titusville that Roy referred to, we moved to Titusville so the commute would be less. But my impression when I first started working out there was, we're working here, but they're still building this complex called the Kennedy Space Center, and the buildings we worked out of were still under construction, parking lots still unpaved, no sod. But we were working out of those facilities. Before that, of course, we were over on the Cape side in Hangar S.
And as the VAB began to take shape, and of course, you had the ONC, the Operations Checkout Building. You had an industrial area with the headquarters building. But when did you first think like you really had a space center? Did it take until the first Saturn V rolled out before you felt that?
Well, it pretty much, because us in spacecraft, it was like there were different worlds at the space center. The launch vehicle folks, guys, mostly male engineers then, they worked out of the VAB Launch Complex 39 area. We were down in the ONC built the manned spacecraft operations building. Okay. And we were still employees of the manned spacecraft center in Houston, which later became, of course, Johnson Center. But we had our own little world.
Well, with that, we're going to take a quick break and then return with more from our July 1st edition of Space Talk, celebrating the 50th anniversary of Kennedy Space Center. I'm Jim Behnke, and you're listening to Best of Space Talk right here on WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
Welcome back to our special Labor Day weekend edition of the best of Space Talk. Now heard each Saturday at 2 p.m. here on WMMB. Today we're listening to a replay of our July 1st program celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy Space Center. We'll be back with a live program next week. In the studio to help us reminisce about those days, the history of the Space Center, and maybe give us a little glimpse into what it might be like in the future, we've got George English, Bob Seek, and Roy Tharp, all veteran KSC managers, officials, launch directors, important community leaders, shall we say, all of the above. And one of the great features about the Space Center being out there, of course, you need a lot of land to make sure you can safely launch. And the neat thing about the Space Center, one of the greatest things, is it is also home to a wildlife refuge. It's been one of the great ongoing stories throughout its history, how technology and nature can coexist together. And George English, you've been at the heart of that. You got the National Wildlife Association,
Merritt Island Wildlife Association.
Got started as well. Talk a little bit about the wildlife, the importance of that, and how you managed launching all this stuff and doing it with all this nature around you.
Well, that's another thing we can give Dr. Deepus credit for. It was named the Merritt Island Wildlife Refuge in 1972. He had negotiated with the Department of Interior to expand some land that they already had to include all of the areas outside the industrial area that we used to have them manage it. That was 1972. And we have, you know, as you said, 143,000 acres of land, and most of it was used as a buffer for the launch areas. And we have something like 300 species of birds and God knows how many plant species we have. We
can't even a lot of endangered species. Yeah,
in addition to those mosquitoes that Roy loves so much.
That's right.
But they're pretty much under control now with the impoundment ponds. But after I retired, Ron Height, who was the superintendent of the refuge, and I've put together the Merritt Island Wildlife Association, and that's been going on for almost 18 years now. But it's a great asset to Brevard County, to the state, to the country, to have that much land undeveloped, and we hope that it will stay that way, where the wildlife can still coexist with the highest technology that we have.
Well, I always like to say that for every launch, there are thousands and thousands gathered along the waterways, and those are just the alligators.
Right. We do have a lot of alligators.
We do have a lot of them. Well, we always like to count them on the way in when we go to the visitor complex. You know whether it's going to be a good day or a bad day, depending on how many alligators you can see in the moat or something.
Right.
But, Bob Seek, let's reminisce a little bit for you. You know, one of the things that I'm fascinated, when you started here, you were involved in medical instrumentation. You got to look at the guy's heartbeats, among other things. A lot of great stories to tell. But I'm fascinated by the fact that you, during Gemini 6, during the abort, when Wally Schirra didn't pull the ejection handle, the rocket ignited, it didn't go anywhere, and you're watching the heart rate, and I'm thinking all these years later as a launch director, I would have loved to measure your heart rate a few times. Talk about that experience a little bit and how.
Well, it was as a journeyman engineer, my first assignment with NASA was really a good one. It was the medical instrumentation that the astronauts wear, and the medical instrumentation engineer is responsible for getting the signal from the astronaut's body down to the blockhouse and mission control. The technology back then isn't what it is today. When you go into a hospital and you'll see one nurse monitoring a dozen patients remotely at a nurse station. But what they had blood pressure, electrocardiogram, heart rate, and the phonocardiogram, what the doctor hears when he listens to your heart with a stethoscope, and blood pressure. And the engineer is responsible for getting that data back. Of course, the flight surgeon is responsible for the health of the astronaut. And in launch count, starting at Gemini 3, that was my first one, the first manned space flight, the astronauts were cool compared to my heart rate.
Right,
they go,
right.
They tick along 70, 80, get close to T0, 90-some, you know, a heart rate of 90, and mine was probably 150. But they worried about whether all the stuff was going to work and if I had to call a hold for what I was responsible for. Anyway, Gemini 6 launch count proceeded normally, And we got down to just about T-zero. The engines ignited on the Titan II rocket and immediately shut down. And then there's all this chatter on the nets that's going on with the safing and whatever. And I'm watching the heart rates along with this flight surgeon there. And they're starting to go up for Wally Schraw and Tom Stafford. Mm-hmm. And they go up and up and up. And they're over 100, 120, 30, 40. And I asked the flight surgeon, I said, well, what's going on here? Are they scared? And he said, no, Bob, they're mad.
They're mad.
He used a different word, but he said, no, they're mad. And that's what happens to your heart rate when you get mad. And then we got into the channels where they were talking, and yeah, they were mad.
Well, you know, the historical purists among us, and there are a few that I'm acquainted with, that would say, well, all that happened at the Cape. That didn't happen at Kennedy Space Center. Well, it's true you had launched from the Cape during those days. Kennedy was the home for the Apollo Saturn V launch rockets, the vehicles. But the whole program of Gemini and the launch operations, that was still all being managed at a KSC. Isn't that right?
Well, it yes. The building of the facilities and overall, we were KSC employees. We started as Manned Spacecraft Center, later Johnson right. Spacecraft right. Center employees. Right. But when KSC was initially activated, all the facilities, and that was in 64 when we actually moved from Hangar S over to KSC administratively. We became KSC employees.
Hey, we have a phone call from Carrie in Melbourne who would like to say something. Carrie, welcome to Space Talk.
Well, two things. First of all, do you know when Fruit Loops is coming back?
We'll have to wait till this fall to find out whether or not he's coming back or what's happening there.
Gentlemen, I would like to thank you so much for inspiring me as a youngster. I knew what you guys were going through. There wasn't any computers. Everything had to be done manually. That's why they give us little glimpses. I never was up to the launch control center, but I never saw so many guys so intense watching those little monitors, and you were an inspiration to a generation of us.
Carrie,
thanks very much.
Carrie, thanks so much for that for those comments. I really do appreciate it. By the way, Carrie's reference, guys, to Fruit Loops, because I'm sure you guys aren't, well, maybe you are, I don't know, fans of the TV show Big Bang Theory, but one of their main characters launched on a Soyuz up to the space station at the season finale, and his nickname, granted to him by Mike Massimino, who was making more than a cameo, he was actually guest starring in the episode, called him Fruit Loops. And by the way, we should note that while it's topical that three folks from the International Space Station returned to Earth this morning, safely landing about 4:14 our time. That included our NASA astronaut Dom Pettit. So there are three others now still on board the space station, and the next crew of three, which is going to include NASA astronaut Sunita Williams, who is the record holder for female spaceflight in the United States, will be flying up to the space station July 14th. So our manned space program continues operating despite the fact that we're not flying. But now talking about shuttle, I want to talk about shuttle Roy Tharp. You know, we know about Apollo 11, and we know about Apollo 17 and 13, and we know about STS-1, and of course we had our we unfortunately lived through Challenger and Columbia and all that. So there's a lot of history being made out there. But you were aware of and involved with, I think, really a big historical milestone for the Space Center, and that is in the way in which our space shuttles were prepared for launch. There was an old way of doing things when shuttle started, and then there was this new way of doing things. The shuttle processing contract, which led to the creation of the company we all know as United Space Alliance, that was a huge deal for the Kennedy Space Center, and I don't think anyone really understands beyond the space community how important that was and really how much that sets the stage for what's yet to come, and I would just like to ask you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, let's see. Jay Honeycutt had asked me to participate in a study to pull all of the contracts that were on the shuttle program, Houston, Florida, Huntsville, and Greenbelt, Maryland. Let's look at all of those contracts and see if there could be one space flight ops contract. And so we participated in that. I headed up a technical committee. There was something like 87 or 96 contracts when you took the little ones, put them all together, and we had a source board out, and it was run out of Houston, And we had folks that would come here on a rotating basis. We would go to Huntsville on a rotating basis in their basement. We would go to the bunkers out in Houston. And then we ran our technical committee out of Kennedy Space Center Source Evaluation Board. But we looked at all of those contracts, condensed almost 1,000 pages of a contract down into less than 100 pages. And it was the first large performance-based contract to be issued. And at that point in time, we consolidated that, and we worked to write a white paper to award that contract to United Space Alliance. And Jay Honeycutt was the one who spearheaded that from a Kennedy Space Center standpoint. So very exciting.
Okay, everyone, stand by as we pause for our usual five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour. We'll take a break, get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. And when we return, we'll continue replaying our conversation from July 1st. I'm Jim Behnke, and you're listening to a Best of Space Talk on WMMV.
This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
Welcome back to our second half of this special Labor Day weekend edition of the Best of Space Talk on WMMV. If you're just tuning in, this is the weekly radio program about our nation's space program. We've been on the air for the past 3 years, more or less, and since this past February have been heard on Sundays, but now with the advent of the NFL regular season, and in my book, the best time of the year, we've moved back to our original time slot of Saturdays at 2 p.m. following the Kim Komando show. I hope you'll find this is a good move like I do, and make it easier for you to stay on top of what's happening in space without missing a single Minnesota Vikings football game this year, or whatever other team you think could possibly be more fun to root for. In any case, we'll be back with a regular live program next week, but for now, we're enjoying a second listen to our Space Talk program from July 1st, in which we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy Space Center with three of our local space legends, George English, Bob Seek, and Roy Tharp. As we resume our discussion with them, former shuttle launch director Bob Seek is describing what it was like to work at KSC back in the day.
As a journeyman engineer, it was a great environment to grow up in and learn in. There was a lot of empowerment, and we were reminded by our management as we first came on board that, hey, this is human spaceflight. You're responsible for this system. In my case, it was the medical instrumentation, and your signature is your warranty that you've met all the requirements, and it's safe. Safety was stressed to launch this guy or these guys in the case of Gemini.
Sure. George English, I want to talk to you a little bit about your role out here because, you know, we talked to Roy and Bob and the other guys. It's all very technical, and we got a lot of great stories to tell in the blockhouse. But, you know, I've always admired you and been fascinated by your job because you were the guy, we joke about you being chief bureaucrat, you were the guy that really put it all together and made it all happen behind the scenes. I like to think of you as the business manager of the Kennedy Space Center. Talk about your role and kind of what were the highlights of your career there.
Well, let me first say that the chief bureaucrat came courtesy of Bob Seek when we were in China. There were five of us. We were the first outsiders to ever visit the launch site in China. They could understand Dick Smith's role. He was the center director. They could understand Bob Seek's role as launch director. Jim Phillips is the chief of engineering, and John Conway is the payloads chief.
Right,
they couldn't understand my job, so Bob said, he was just the chief bureaucrat.
And so, that they got, right?
That they got.
But you made it all happen behind the scenes. You put organizations together. I think you watched the budget, politics, protocol.
That plus, yeah.
That and everything right. else.
Well, I will chime in because George was the architect on the fourth floor in the smokehouse where they're looking at the organization, they're looking at the potentials for individuals, and he was part of setting up the future of KSC as to who these leaders would be. And George, I can thank you on the air, but thank you for my career, both you and Bob. I appreciate that.
Well, the term godfather sometimes come to mind with George.
Well, we talk about the fourth floor, and that's exactly what it reminds me of, the Godfather. You know, there's all these huge, giant buildings and 195-foot level and a 525-foot story VAB and all that. But the fourth floor was the top center of it all, which was, of course, the headquarters building where the Senate director resided or presided or depending on the personality.
Right.
Yeah, and talk about that, George. You worked with quite a few of the Senate directors.
Well, there were have been 10 Senate directors at KSC, and I worked for five of them.
Mm-hmm. Including Dr. Debus, the first.
Dr. Debus, I was his manpower officer and did the manpower and organization, as Roy said. And then I became the executive officer after Dick Smith came, and I was in the executive officer for the last almost 20 years that I was there. So I did policy development and an application, and also had some line functions, believe it or not. I wasn't just a bureaucrat. I oversaw, of course, I kept the manpower and organization function. I oversaw the management of the offsite offices at Patrick and Vandenberg. Aircraft operations reported to me. Industrial engineering under the guise of management systems reported to me. So I had some functions other than just the guy in the shadows.
Well, and I want to spend a little bit more time on Dr. Debus because, you know, we have our Debus Award with the National Space Club, and every year it comes up, well, who's Dr. Debus? And there's, you know, I think even half the people out of the Space Center still don't even know who he is or how to pronounce his name. But, and George, maybe this is best for you, I don't, because I know you knew him and the family so well. How much of what we know of as the Kennedy Space Center, the way it looks, the way it operates, the VAB rolling out to the pad, the whole look, the whole way that it all has come together, can be traced back to Dr. Debus and drawing on a napkin maybe with Wernher von Braun at a bar?
Well, so much of it comes directly from Debus, the concept of the crawler, VAB, concept of the VAB, and the supporting ground systems that we had came from his imagination and his foresight.
And jumping way ahead, Bob, here, because we took Apollo and we modified it to become Shuttle. So you had, and I know you were very early on in Shuttle program here at KSC. How much of that was a challenge? And from that, what do you learn as the folk look forward to adopting Shuttle for future, or Shuttle pads, 39A and B, for future use?
Well, the challenge, that there was a couple of challenges from transitioning from Apollo to Shuttle. One was the dependence on automation and computers and the complexity that went with that. Even in Apollo, yeah, there were some computers, but it was for the most part manual. The spacecraft were designed to be flown by the astronauts, not by a computer. And so all the engineers, the technical workforce, had to finally learn what computers were all about, because heretofore only the folks involved with the guidance system on the spacecraft or the launch vehicle really understood computers. So there was this cultural transition that had to occur. And then there was this in Apollo, the good thing about Apollo was everything was factory fresh, brand new. Other than the ground equipment, which was still new, all the flight hardware was either put in the ocean or retired.
Right.
After we flew, well, now we had to get used to this repetitive, we're going to refly it, and all the engineering and the challenges that goes with that. And I think as I project to the future, the lesson learned from having to make that transition is, however you design the spaceships, the launch complexes of the future, keep it simple.
Yeah. Yeah. And simple checkout, self tests, green light, red light kind of stuff. You don't have to tear the thing apart and refly it 100 times on the ground before you launch it.
Absolutely. Keep the number of the technical term as interfaces. Keep the number of those to a minimum.
Now let's go back a little bit. Now, Roy Tharp, let's talk about a little about Apollo, and maybe this is a thing for Bob or Roy, I'm not sure, but in terms of what it was like to work here during Apollo and on the floor and doing spacecraft checkout and doing launch operations, you know, there's stories about taking naps in the transfer aisle of the VAB. There's stories about guys that didn't see their families for 6 weeks on end. How crazy was it, and could you get away with that today?
Well, it was a fact. I mean, we worked, if you were going to work on the launch team, you were working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and that could go on for months and months and months. One of my very good friends hired in with Rocketdyne came to work one day and worked 12 straight months, 7 days a week. And so, you know, it was part of what we were there to do. And that work was great work. We would work 12 hours. We would have a shift tie-in. We would go home. We didn't have cell phones, so we would grab the landline. We would call back to the control room, and we would then make sure that what we left that test conductor to do for the next 12 hours was what we had set it out to do. So I'm telling you, we had one test conductor who had a back problem. We had a guy who had come from Miami. His dad was a chiropractor. He was a studying chiropractor. We call that guy from the pad to come in. We put this guy on two tables. We gave him an adjustment, sent him back to the firing room to finish up his 12-hour shift. And that is a fact. We had cots in the VAB where people would go in and sleep. We had people who slept in their cars. That was not only in Apollo, but that was in the early shuttle also, Jim.
That's incredible. Now stand by as we take our final break of the day. And when we come back, we'll wrap up our trip down memory lane with some stories from George English about his dealings with the VIP visitors who dropped into KSC from time to time. Plus, we'll look at the local launch forecast and tell you what's coming up on Space Talk when we return with the live show next Saturday, September 8th. At 2 p.m. In the meantime, if you'd like to stay in touch with us throughout the week, you can find us on Facebook by searching for Space Talk, or you can follow us on Twitter at Space Talking. We're also online with our own website. Just go to WMMBAM.com and type in the keywords Space Talk for all the updates about the program. Plus, you'll find links to archived recordings of previous shows, as well as our weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. For now, I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to a best of Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
Well, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's special Labor Day weekend edition of the Best of Space Talk here on WMMB. If you're just tuning in and wondering what you're listening to, this is a weekly one-hour program about our nation's space program. We've been on the air for the past 3 years, originally on Saturdays at 2 p.m., where we have now returned. It was after about a six-month hiatus in the program because of a lengthy stay in the hospital last year by yours truly that in February when we returned to flight on Sundays. But with the return of the NFL regular season, WMMB's managers here have moved Space Talk back to Saturdays so they can carry live coverage of the Jacksonville Jaguars, which is just fine by me as that also means I won't miss any games of my Minnesota Vikings. Well, anyway, now before we wrap up today's program, let's take a moment for our weekly look at the local launch forecast. As we put together this special Best of Space Talk program, the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket with NASA's Radiation Belt Storm Probes mission had not flown yet, thanks to a technical and weather-related problems they were targeting last Thursday for their next launch attempt. Since this is a recording, you already know what happened. But looking ahead to the launch schedule at the Cape, I can tell you that September will be a quiet month, with our next space shot now targeted for October 4th, when the Delta IV is to carry a new GPS satellite into orbit. Following that, we hope to see the next Falcon 9 launch to the International Space Station later that month, and an Atlas V also in October will be carrying the X-37B military space plane back into orbit. Two more launches are planned from the Cape in December, and that should round out the year for us. In any case, for more information about this and all the various launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com. Keywords Space Talk and look for the link to our launch forecast. In our remaining moments, let's pick up the rest of our program from July 1st, when we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy Space Center with George English, Bob Seek, and Roy Tharp. And George English, we want to spend a moment with you now and talking about your work with Protocol. You kind of got stuck giving the tours for everybody throughout your career.
So I was the interface with other government agencies in Congress. And back in Apollo, of course, we had a ton of congressmen, not so many in shuttle, but back in the Apollo program. It was sometimes very frustrating. We had several presidential visits and even more vice presidential visits. And, of course, working with Secret Service and with the advance teams sometimes got to be a bit of a problem, particularly with the advance team.
Oh, I can imagine they wanted all sorts of things.
And didn't want to pay for anything.
Didn't want to pay for anything. Right. And didn't give you the increase in budget to help you pay for anything.
Never.
It's still the same, George.
Some things never change.
But it was easy for me to say no to some of those things they wanted.
You mentioned all the vice presidents. Of course, everyone knows I'm born and raised a Minnesotan, and so I have a lot of affection for the vice president, Hubert Humphrey.
Well, Hubert Humphrey was probably the most popular politician that ever visited Kennedy Space Center. Very down-to-earth guy. He would walk down the halls of the headquarters building, and employees would come out and applaud when he would walk by.
He was just a
very easy guy to know. And I'm sure you probably remember that some of our local people went to the vice president to get some funding for a bridge over the Indian River, and it's now named the Hubert Humphrey Bridge.
So there he is.
That helped our traffic situation
a
lot.
About
helped
him all
Roy
the time.
Get out of cocoa.
Yeah. Yes. Hey, we got just a couple minutes left. I do want to ask you all to give me your favorite, your top memory, whether it's a favorite launch or a moment that just says Kennedy Space Center to you as you look back on your time out there. Bob Seek, let's start with you. We'll just go around the table.
Well, I think for me it was return to flight after Challenger when NASA was at its lowest since I'd been an employee. Obviously, morale was low. We had Kennedy, particularly, we had a lot of layoffs. Our confidence was low, and there was some talk about whether or not we'd even fly again. Well, fortunately, Forrest McCartney was named center director to replace Dick Smith, who left, and he. He came into KSC and he brought us together again as a team and brought up our confidence and not just at KSC. He had an effect, I think, across the agency with what his leadership skills and his integrity brought to our mission. And I'll be forever grateful to both him and George English for appointing me as launch director after Challenger. For the next, almost a decade of missions, because prior to that, I had been the operations director, and that was probably the most rewarding time of my career. So that would have to be the highlight.
George, Forrest McCartney, absolutely an outstanding man. A shout out to him and Miss Ruth, great people. Roy Tharp, you got about 45 seconds for your story.
Well, I've got to say shuttle. Transitioning from Apollo, we took a team to California under Bob Seek, and we went through the approach and landing test, coming back to KSC and then launching the first shuttle and then going to Edwards for the landing. That was white knuckle all the way through, and seeing that beast come through, clipping the atmosphere and the clouds in front of it, that had to have been the highlight. And I am really happy that I've spent almost 60 years out at Kennedy Space Center.
That's great. George English, what's your story?
Well, Apollo 11, I escorted our administrator then, Tom Payne.
Tom Payne,
and the Secretary of the Air Force, who had been a deputy administrator of NASA, Bob Seaman. The traffic was such that I had to have a helicopter to pick them up at Patrick early in the morning. Got to fly around 39A with Apollo 11 all lighted and see a million people in Brevard County to see that launch. I'll never forget that.
That was our program for July 1st. And again, I thank George English, Bob Seek, and Roy Tharp for such a memorable program. We'll return next week with a live edition of Space Talk, when we'll be joined by three more legends of our space program who are being recognized this month by the National Space Club Florida Committee with annual Lifetime Achievement Awards. In the meantime, don't forget our inbox at spacetalking@AOL.com is always open for your questions and comments. And for one-stop shopping about the program, point your online browser to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, where you can find a podcast of today's program, along with links to an archive of previous shows and online versions of our broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. That's all for now. Space Talk is a production of Mila Solutions and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for our program today. Please join us next week at our new time of Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for another live hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents the Glenn Beck Weekend Program. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon.